طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. Sharif Fahm created This Week in Palestine, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We're going to be discussing Palestinian identity with one of the most vigorous Palestinian voices in the diaspora, a great favorite of ours, Ali Abu Nima. But first I want to read excerpts of a disturbing article he wrote in his publication, The Electronic Intifada. And I am now quoting from the article. When Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won an upset primary victory in June of 2018, it came as a breath of fresh air for supporters of Palestinian rights. The month before she unseated a senior member of the Democratic Party, she had expressed her solidarity with the unarmed Palestinians being gunned down by Israeli snipers as they protested in the besieged Gaza Strip. "This is a massacre," she tweeted, on the day Israeli soldiers killed 160 Palestinians. "I hope my peers have the moral courage to call it such," she said. No state or entity is absolved of mass shootings of protesters. There is no justification. Palestinian people deserve a basic human dignity as anyone else. "Democrats can't be silent about this anymore," she said. What a difference 3 years and two elections to Congress make. On April 1st, Ocasio-Cortez did an online event with the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York, her first meeting with the Israel lobby group. The event might have gone unnoticed, but for a tweet on Wednesday from left-wing activist and journalist Ryan Wentz, gently criticizing her incredibly underwhelming response to a question about peace, both between Israelis and Palestinians. On April 1st, AOC did a live stream with Michael Miller, the head of the Jewish Community Relations Council of New York. She was asked about peace between Israelis and Palestinians. Her response was incredibly underwhelming, to say the least. Ocasio-Cortez's vacuous word salad of an answer, which completely failed to address Israel's violence against Palestinians or call for accountability, went viral, with thousands of responses and retweets mocking it. "I'm incredibly impressed with AOC's Obama-like ability to fill large amounts of time with words while saying absolutely nothing. I challenge anyone to tell me what she said." In a deeply disturbing development, Wentz was tracked down at his Los Angeles home by California State Police after he posted the video. They were acting at the bequest of the U.S. Capitol Police. Wentz told the Greystown publication, "The officer said we got a warning about a sitting member of Congress, and it was because of your tweet, which tagged them in it. And then they just wouldn't back down from this accusation, and I threatened to kill her." Ocasio-Cortez's office has denied reporting Wentz's tweet to the Capitol Police, Though the episode is raising alarms about increasing police state-style censorship of U.S. online discourse, Ocasio-Cortez has been on the front line of calls for online speech policing and censorship. Wentz further stated, "I'm really shaken up right now. I was just visited by two plainclothes police officers from the Highway Patrol at my home. They said they came here on behalf of the Capitol Police and they accused me of threatening on Twitter yesterday. This is provably false." While a segment of Ocasio-Cortez's comments shared by Wentz attracted widespread derision, there are other troubling parts of her discussion with the JCRC of New York that have escaped attention. JCRC New York CEO Michael Miller used the interview with Ocasio-Cortez to advance the claim that Israel is a leader in the environmental sustainability, especially in water conservation, reforesting, and solar power. Miller spoke about seeing an Israeli aid project in Ocasio-Cortez's ancestral home of Puerto Rico, a country she calls colonized by the United States and whose self-determination she champions. At an April 1st event with an Israel lobby group, AOC echoes Israel's greenwashing propaganda that it uses to cover up its theft of Palestinian land. Ocasio-Cortez, the author of the Green New Deal, ought to have seized this opportunity to point out the striking parallels between Puerto Rico's colonization by the United States and Palestine's U.S.-backed colonization by Israel. She could have denounced Israel's greenwashing propaganda, which aims to falsely paint it as an exemplary environmental steward, often as a cover for ethnic cleansing and theft of even more Palestinian land. Instead, she answered, "Absolutely," before going on to praise Israel's technology around wastewater circulation. These technological marvels will come as news to 2 million Palestinians caged by Israel in Gaza, where due to Israel's wars and blockade, 97% of the water is undrinkable, and conditions are like living in a septic tank. While Ocasio-Cortez's dismal performance during the JCRC New York event sparked with widespread ridicule, a basic question is why a self-proclaimed champion of human rights and racial justice agreed to participate at all. Ocasio-Cortez's path into the arms of the JCRC New York, and who knows which Israel lobby group might be next, has been discernible from the start, even if it has had a few detours on the way. Within weeks of her stunning June 2018 primary win, she already showed signs of buckling under pro-Israel pressure. When challenged on PBS about her description of Israel's mass killings of unarmed Palestinians as a massacre, she replied defensively, "Well, I believe absolutely in Israel's right to exist. I am a proponent of the two-state solution." That represented a quick reversion to accepted Democratic Party orthodoxy. She also said apologetically that she was not an expert on geopolitics on this issue. She was given the chance to address the stumble less than 2 weeks later in an interview with Outlet Mike, but Ocasio-Cortez dodged the question and did not mention Palestine at all. Ocasio-Cortez appears to have taken the lesson to heart. Since her May 2018 massacre tweet, she has rarely tweeted to her 12 million followers about Palestinians or about Israel's abuses at all. She never again tweeted about Gaza. Last year, Ocasio-Cortez delivered another shock to supporters of Palestinian rights when she agreed to participate in an Israel lobby event honoring Yitzhak Rabin, the late Israeli prime minister responsible for decades of expulsions and war crimes against Palestinians. Amid strong criticism from Palestinians and supporters, Ocasio-Cortez backed out of the Rabin event. But in hindsight, given her recent embrace of JCRC New York, it appears her initial acceptance of the Rabin event was not a hapless mistake, but a calculated effort to curry favor with the Israel lobby. True, Ocasio-Cortez has still occasionally taken positions that go beyond those of mainstream Democrats. Last summer, she angered the lobby group AIPAC by spearheading a congressional letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that called for putting conditions on U.S. funding for Israel if it proceeded with formal annexation of land in the occupied West Bank. This letter appears to be the only item on her official website that refers to Palestinians. And while she has not endorsed BDS, Ocasio-Cortez did co-sponsor a 2019 resolution introduced by Ilhan Omar supporting the right to engage in boycotts as a matter of principle, though that resolution did not explicitly mention Israel. Ocasio-Cortez's embrace of an Israel lobby group like JCRC is of a piece with her widely noted shift towards the center of the Democratic Party. The backlash over her response to the question on Palestinians recalls the outpouring of disgust earlier this month when she deflected criticism from the Biden administration's continuation of cruel Trump-like era policies of detaining migrant and refugee children at the U.S.-Mexican border. Under Trump, she had called the detention practices concentration camps, language that has now disappeared from her vocabulary. It also follows the backlash in December over the refusal by Ocasio-Cortez and every other member of her allegedly progressive squad to withhold their support from Nancy Pelosi. It also follows the backlash in December over the refusal by Ocasio-Cortez and every other member of her allegedly progressive squad to withhold their support from Nancy Pelosi to force a vote on Medicare for All. At the time, Ocasio-Cortez fell into line behind Pelosi on the basis that it would preserve progressives' leverage to win a $15 minimum wage. But then when Ocasio-Cortez and the squad had the opportunity to hold up the Biden administration's must-pass COVID-19 relief package, unless it included the overwhelmingly popular minimum wage hike, they refused to do that too. During an interview with Democratic Socialists of America last month, Ocasio-Cortez slammed leftists skeptical that progressive policy could come from out of Biden's administration as espousing a really privileged critique and suggested that they were bad faith actors. Ocasio-Cortez's shift to the right, including her embrace of the Israeli lobby and echoing its propaganda, could be linked to reports that she may mount a primary challenge against Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. or it may be motivated by the mundane and routine personal interests of almost every politician who seeks to stay in office and advance through the ranks of their party. None of that would make Alexandria Cortez remarkable, but no one should mistake her for a courageous champion of human rights, especially those of Palestinians. That was an article written by Ali Abanima of the Electronic Intifada. It is a very disappointing article to process. Congress desperately needs new progressive voices, especially on the issue of Palestine. And we would like to think that that is happening with the election of progressives like AOC, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, as well as Jeremy Bowman, Mondaire Jones, and of course Betty McCollum, and a few others who are speaking up in the Democratic caucus trying to put forward the Palestinian narrative. So when a prominent member of the new progressives, as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, falls victim to the Israeli lobby and begins to mouth their false narrative, it is more than disappointing. It is devastating. The power of the lobby to exert its will in the halls of American government and beyond is once again demonstrated, and it must be vigorously opposed. AOC, who is an important progressive voice on issues like the Green New Deal, cannot be abandoned by progressives. But she must feel the wrath of her base when she falters on key progressive initiatives. I do not know what Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar are saying to AOC these days, but they cannot be very happy with their backsliding squad cohort. It is bad enough that so many black civil rights advocates in Congress, such as Cory Booker, James Clyburn, Hakeem Jeffries, and Vice President Kamala Harris, will not see the parallels of the segregation and discrimination in U.S. society to those of Israel. Even John Lewis, when he was alive, was a pro-Zionist voice in Congress. As the term apartheid society is being increasingly demonstrated as a reality in Israel, and it is revealed that there are some 60 Israeli laws that discriminate in favor of Jews over Palestinians and other minority Israeli citizens, all we seem to hear is that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, which of course it is not. So we have to let AOC know that we will not tolerate her inconsistent behavior. Obviously, she is trying to grease the skids for political advancement, which always seems to take away whatever pro-Palestinian wind might be in a politician's sails. As Catherine Clark has moved into the leadership ranks of the House of Representatives, she is backing away from positions on Palestine she had taken earlier. This is the path AOC seems to be taking, and we cannot afford to lose her without a fight. Let AOC and the squad know where you stand, especially when they ask for money. And while you're at it, add Catherine Clark. Today we feature Palestinian journalist and author Ali Abanima in a podcast moderated by Misbah Khan that explores Palestinian identity, specifically Ali Abanima's identity as a Palestinian raised in the diaspora. The presentation begins with introductions.
Today we'll be in conversation with Ali Abanima. Ali is the director of the widely acclaimed publication, The Electronic Intifada, an independent nonprofit publication focusing on Palestine. He has written hundreds of articles and spoken on the topic all over the world. He is the author of One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse, and The Battle for Justice in Palestine. Ali, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
So the first question that I would like to pose to you, which is our running theme throughout this entire series, is what does it mean to you personally to be a Palestinian?
You know, that's a very simple question with a very difficult answer. And I think one thing to say, I think it's changed over the years. And probably everyone goes through such changes. And I probably can't accurately tell you what it has meant to me at every stage in my life. But what it means to me now, of course, it means having a certain family history and ancestry and connection to a place that, you know, I have rarely set foot in. I've been there a few times, but I haven't been to, the last time I was in Palestine was in Gaza in 2013. And before that, it was quite a few years. And most Palestinians have never been to Palestine. So it's having a connection with a place through family connections. I still do have family living in Palestine, but also through stories and through you know, the things my parents have told me and still tell me about their childhood and their memories of Palestine. So those things are probably very common to people from any place in the world or who are connected to any place in the world. But I think the other thing that being Palestinian means to me, and I feel this more and more, is it gives you a certain perspective on the world, which is, at least for me, the ability to see where a lot of political hypocrisy lies. Because Palestine is often the test of, you know, as they say in America, it's where the rubber hits the road in terms of a politician's or a party's or an institution's or a media publication's willingness to be truthful, willingness to apply whatever principles they claim to uphold, whether it's about free speech or human rights. You immediately see it when it comes to Palestine. You can tell right away if this person is a, I don't know if I'm allowed to say bullshitter, but that's the word I mean. So I'm just going to say it. So it gives you a certain clarifying perspective on the world. I think that's what I feel it gives me now.
So you've grown up in the United States and specifically in Chicago. How has it been maneuvering as a Palestinian in that society growing up and, you know, in Chicago and the way that you've seen, you know, so obviously within American society and being Palestinian and how often, I mean, it comes across as the two identities might clash in some way.
Right. Well, I've lived in the United States for about 30 years. And before that, I lived, you can hear in my accent, I lived for some years in the UK and in Europe. And I came to the United States when I was 18 and have been here ever since. So I've had experience of a number of places. I think, you know, in the United States, and I think this is true in other places as well, at least from my experience of talking to other Palestinians, is that you often have this experience. This is common to people from, you know, almost any non-European background when you're in the US or you're in certain countries where people naively, they don't mean it naively, they'll ask you, oh, well, where are you from? Or they hear my accent, they say, where are you from? And those conversations can be exhausting for a number of reasons. Sometimes you want to have the conversation, but often, you know, you just, if you're sitting on a train or a plane, you just want to be left alone. You don't, I mean, Americans are very talkative. I often have this experience where if you get on a plane The person who you're going to sit next to for an hour and a half or two immediately wants to have a conversation, tell you their whole life story. I mean, that might not be true in other parts of the world, but it's very true in the US. People are very open and very talkative. And if you get into one of those conversations, then they'll inevitably ask, well, where are you from? And I often don't want to say, you know, I'm Palestinian or my background is Palestinian, because then you get into an exhausting conversation. You then become sort of responsible for educating them, responsible for answering all their questions. And, you know, sometimes you want to have that conversation, but sometimes you just want to read your book. Or, you know, maybe I've just been doing that all day on a discussion like this or writing an article, and now I don't want to talk about it. So the point I'm getting at is that the moment you say you're Palestinian, that is a very political, almost provocative statement. So that's how it's perceived. I'm not saying that that's how it's intended, but that's how it's perceived. So I think a lot of, you know, my own experience and the experience of others I talk to is you really think a few times before you say you identify yourself as Palestinian, because you have to think about, well, what it will mean in terms of anything from the relatively minor inconvenience of having to have a conversation you don't want to possibly much greater discrimination that people experience. So that's an experience I've had many times. I don't know that it's unique to Palestinians, but it's certainly one a lot of Palestinians have had.
No, I can imagine that pretty easily, especially with being on the news all the time and, you know, sort of the Israeli perspective getting the limelight most of the time. So it'll be like, oh, what do you think, you know, about this matter? And you're automatically put into a position that might not necessarily something that you might be looking forward to on, like, you know, just a quiet night. So it's interesting. The responsibility that you just mentioned about being, you know, that you have as a Palestinian, how do you think that comes about? Like, you know, how has that made you feel growing up, you know, or just as you are at the moment? Is it something that, you know, have you struggled with it before?
I mean, I'm sure I've struggled with it in the sense that I don't think I set out to spend most of my time doing work on Palestine or writing about Palestine. In fact, you know, when I was younger, that was something I didn't want to do. It's not that I was against it. It's just that I thought, you know, I would be doing something else. But it... you know, that's the way my work developed, and it's something that I was able to do. It's something I felt a responsibility to do. It's not a responsibility that anyone imposed on me. It's a responsibility I felt from within. And it's, you know, there might be other things I could have done for sure. But when I compare that to sort of the costs and sacrifices that other people, you know, have faced because of what they've contributed to the Palestinian struggle, I've really given up nothing. You know, I've had a fortunate background in terms of my education or the opportunities I've had, and I don't feel I've made any sort of great sacrifice to take on that responsibility. But you know, it's something I do. I feel like I do what I can do. You know, I use the whatever skills I have to do this work, and you know, that's, you know, what impact it has or what merit it has is for others to decide.
Reasonable enough. I wanted to ask you, what does lifta mean to you? Because we've gotten very interesting answers from people that have, thought about the pieces of land that they're from back in Palestine, or their parents are from in Palestine. And it's taken on a symbolic meaning for a lot of them. Has it had a similar experience for you?
Well, Lifta is the village where my mother is from, and it's a village that is west of Jerusalem. Now it's sort of surrounded by Jerusalem, and it was one of the first villages from which Palestinians were forcibly expelled in December 1947, as the Zionist militias began their assault on the city. And on Palestinian villages all over Palestine. It was one of the first that was attacked. There was an attack on a cafe in the village by a Zionist gang that killed several people, and that effectively terrorized the population into leaving. And my mother recalls that she was a little girl at that time, that they left first to stay with friends or relatives in another part of Jerusalem, and eventually they went to Jordan, where they became refugees. So, Lifta is a place I've always heard about all my life. It's a place that still exists. It's one of the few villages that is still largely intact. It's in ruins, but a lot of the houses are intact. And that's unusual because Israel, after it was established, they set about deliberately destroying many of the villages to leave no trace. And in fact, Lifta in recent years was the subject of an Israeli development plan, which would have put luxury apartments there or something for primarily for Israeli Jewish residents. And there has been a movement by descendants of survivors and descendants of the village of Lifta, many of whom live in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem now, of going back to Lifta, of holding ceremonies there, of just being physically present in the village. And there have been legal challenges to the plan, which so far has not proceeded. And there are, of course, people saying quite rightly that this is, not only do people have a right to return to Lifta, but Lifta should not be destroyed. I mean, no place like Lifta should be destroyed, but it should particularly not be destroyed because there are so few surviving examples of a village like Lifta with vernacular Palestinian architecture going back hundreds of years. And it would be, yet another desecration to destroy it. So I have a strong personal connection to Lifta, but Lifta is also the story of hundreds of Palestinian towns and villages to which millions of Palestinians trace their roots. It just happens to be the place that I have a personal connection to.
My next question would be, you have strongly expressed your support for a one-state solution, which it's controversial amongst, Palestinians themselves and obviously in the international community. In a one-state what do you see, what shape do you see Palestinian identity taking within this state if it was to occur?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's one where I think, I want to give you two answers or follow two strands of thinking on this. I think now there's a lot more openness to a one-state solution than a few years ago or when I wrote my book on it in 2006 or 2007. It's a much less controversial idea now, I think, because the so-called two-state solution is so discredited. But one of the objections I would get, particularly from Palestinians, was that, from some Palestinians, I don't want to suggest all Palestinians think the same, obviously they don't, but people tied the notion of being Palestinian very strongly to having a state. So the reaction was, well, you know, you want to dissolve the Palestinian identity. You're going to, like, we're just going to have no identity, or you're going to give that up. And my answer to that was, well, you have a very strong Palestinian identity, but you've never had a state. So you have all this Palestinian identity, but no state. So why do you need a state to have a Palestinian identity? However you define that identity, it has never actually been tied to a state. It is actually much more tied to statelessness, but it is no less strong for that. It is no less deeply felt or expressed because it has not taken the form of a state. I encounter that much less now, I would have to say. The idea that a state is central to sort of affirming and protecting and establishing Palestinian identity is one that I hear less. The other answer I want to give you is that these are questions that, you know, what is identity, or what is a national identity, that are common everywhere. But where you might look specifically for, indicators or clues of the kinds of battles and struggles that we would face in a one-state solution would be to play, and I've written about this, would be places like the north of Ireland, where you have two, what they call traditions, unionists and nationalists. And there, in the 20 or so years since the Belfast Agreement, which I think was in 1998, there have been efforts about, well, what do these identities mean, when one of them, the unionist identity, has been particularly tied to domination and oppression of the other. So, you know, how can you remake an identity that does not have sort of bigotry and domination and built into it? And so I think that those would be the struggles we'd face. Is what, you know, whatever Israeli national identity is, Israeli Jewish national identity in particular, it is tied to domination. It is tied to supremacy. And so I think the struggle would really be for Israeli Jews to come up with some kind of identity that is not about dominating the land, taking the land, holding privilege and superior rights. And that would, you know, so those are the kinds of challenges of decolonization that we see in places like Northern Ireland and places like South Africa that are extremely difficult on a cultural level, but also on an economic level, because if you take somewhere like South Africa, you see that economic inequality has actually increased since the end of formal apartheid. And, you know, even though people formally have equal citizenship, they don't have equal access to resources. So those are the kinds of struggles that we have to look at and learn from, that you cannot divorce these issues of identity from questions of power and questions of economic justice and economic democracy, because people's identity is often is for, you know, there's people a lot smarter than me who write about these things, but the way I think about it is that, you know, identity is tied to power. You know, so in the United States, so much of white nationalist identity is tied to a notion that Europeans have a natural right to rule this country, that they were the people who established the United States, and that the United States is a Christian nation, and you know, the, all these ideas that are tied to domination and power that seem very naturalized by those notions of identity. So it's very hard to see where it would go, but I think that you know, people do worry about symbolic things like flags and anthems and languages and all of those things. But I think you really have to focus on, to a large extent, on the power relations that exist between these different identity groups.
Would you say that a compromise is needed in that sense on both the Palestinian and Israeli side to bring about some sort of a resolution as to what a Palestinian / Israeli state would look like?
I don't know if compromise is the right word. I think you have to have inclusion and you have to have justice. So, you know, I think that, you know, some kind of common state, you would have, you know, equal regard for the languages people use. You would have, you know, equal protection for people's ability to practice religion. You would have, you know, protection for people's various educational rights. And the question that, you know, a lot of scholars and thinkers and people who look at these things struggle with is how to do all those things while at the same time producing, you know, enough of a common identity that people feel that, you know, even though they have their own languages and their own religions and their own, you know, cultural institutions, that there's also a common allegiance and a common state or common symbols that they can equally subscribe to. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be sort of an easy way to make that happen. I think there is, you know, there are ways that facilitate that, but that is a tough challenge. But those are the things you would have to balance. But just to be clear, there's no contradiction to me between having, you know, a single democratic state and people having, you know, full recognition over their languages and cultural rights and so on. There's no contradiction there to me.
Would you say, with the normalization process that's taking place in the Middle East at the moment, as of recent, you know, with actually even North Africa and Morocco joining that club, what impact is that having on this solution, you know, from actually taking place? And how do you think that's affecting the sort of the relationship Palestinians have to the Arab world?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of, among Palestinians, very strong opposition to those deals, but there's also strong opposition among the citizens of those countries where they can express it. You know, in Morocco, there is near unanimous public opposition to normalization with Israel, and I suspect that's true in other countries as well. It's true in Jordan, which has had a peace treaty with Israel for more than 25 years. It's very consistent. So these agreements, these peace treaties, haven't softened public opinion. They haven't made people abandon their support for Palestinians, but they have in some ways, they reduce the leverage Palestinians have, because Israel is, in a sense, getting rewarded for free. But that, it's also important to know that these deals are largely formalizing longstanding clandestine or semi-open relationships that these regimes already had with Israel. And I think it's a reminder of the geopolitics involved, which is that all of these regimes, including Israel, are essentially clients of the U.S. empire, and so they have an interest in sort of banding together, and the U.S. has an interest in making sure that its sort of regional vassal states get along as well as possible. So there's geopolitics involved. How it will play out in 5, 10, 15, 20 years is hard to say. If the claim is that, Arabs and Israelis get along so well, then why would if Israel can have peace and great relations with Emiratis and Bahrainis and Moroccans, as they claim, then why can't they have equality with Palestinians at home? So in essence, it could be construed as further undermining arguments for the racist and segregationist two-state solution.
Which often doesn't make coherent sense, as we can see, whenever the narrative is brought up. On our side, those are all the questions that we do have regarding, Palestinian identity. And thank you so much for that insight. Are there any concluding remarks that you would like to make regarding, sort of Palestinian identity, how it's evolved, or how do you think it's going to evolve? A lot of our speakers have had messages for Palestinians themselves. Would you like to make any remarks?
I think one thing I'm more conscious of is that there is no single Palestinian identity. There are certainly things that tie all Palestinians together. But Palestinian communities have had so many different experiences in so many different places as a consequence of their statelessness and their expulsion from their homeland, the identities that Palestinians have developed come from very different experiences. My experiences are very particular. The experiences of Palestinians who came to the United States in the 1980s as students and then settled here are very different from those of their children and grandchildren. Who are born in the United States as second generation or third generation Palestinians. The experience of Palestinians in refugee camps in Lebanon or of Palestinians who grew up in the Gulf are very different. And so that's the thing I would stress also is the multiplicity of Palestinian experiences that shape identity. And so we can't assume that. And there's also, of course, has always been a class aspect within Palestine and within Palestinian communities that like every society, you have class distinctions and rural versus city distinctions that are very strong. So a lot of the things that people strongly associate with Palestinian identity, such as embroidery or agricultural practices or certain kinds of food, may have been staples for rural Palestinians, but not necessarily Palestinians in the city. They may have adopted them later, or they may have adopted them as symbols in the diaspora. A lot of these are things that I'm not an expert on, but they're things I observe and think about. And so those are some of the questions I would ask if I were setting out on a deeper or broader inquiry into Palestinian identity.
You have been listening to Ali Abunima in conversation with Misbah Khan discussing Palestinian identity. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can find all our past broadcasts on our permanent archive at truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org. Click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there, due to the diligence of our colleague and sound editor, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning. من مخيم